Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 393. Well, usually I promote stuff, but now I have to promote some crap news, which is I was supposed to perform in Minneapolis at the beginning of September, and I have to cancel those dates. I'm so sorry. If you had already purchased tickets, I was going to be at Acme in Minneapolis. The problem is that that those shows were set up before we went back into production for the Talking Bad, and it's live on Sundays, and I am not able to travel back to Los Angeles the same day that we have to be on the air live. Because if anything happens, if the flights are canceled because of weather, if anything, I am screwed and possibly really fired. So I am not allowed to travel back the same day that we have a tape day. So I'm so sorry. The shows will be rescheduled, and please don't be mad at me. But if you weren't going to come see the show, then this doesn't affect you at all. You're fine. Everything's great. This episode was brought to you by Audible.com. If you go to audible.com/Nerdist, you can get a free audiobook download. Might I recommend David Sedaris' latest book, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. That is available on audible.com right now. Listen whenever you want, wherever you want. If you don't want to get that one, they have over 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has you covered. Again, that's audible.com/Nerdist. Get your free audiobook download. This episode of the podcast is Vince Gilligan, who is the creator and showrunner for Breaking Bad, which is about to come to a close. On Sunday, August 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern, Breaking Bad will begin the first of its final 8 episodes, and it's going to be a bummer. It's going to be a bummer, because it's one of the best shows in the history of television, and it's going away after only 5 seasons, but we will be on doing Talking Bad at 11, so it'll be Breaking Bad, Low Winter Sun, which is a new AMC show, and then us Talking Bad for a half hour. Vince Gilligan will be the guest that night on the first episode with Julie Bowen from Modern Family, and then every week after that for 7 more weeks. Then we will have cast members and other folks that you might recognize who are huge fans of the show. And we will try to take you guys through the mourning process of losing Breaking Bad in a fun, respectful way. But Vince, who also was an EP on X-Files, is just a fantastic guy. I mean, we thought we were only going to get an hour with him. And, you know, I took a bunch of questions from Reddit. We had I kind of grilled him about talking about Breaking Bad for probably about an hour and 40 minutes. And his answers were great and thoroughly satisfying. I would like to say that there are way, way, way a lot of spoilers in this. So if you're not caught up on Breaking Bad, then you might want to skip this episode. And if you are, then I think it'll be a nice companion piece as we go into the final 8. So here you go. Nerds Podcast number 393 with Vince Gilligan.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Jonah.
Jonah, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Matt, nice to meet you.
That's Kyle. Hi, Kyle, close the door, will you, please?
Let Mr. Gilligan sit down and get comfortable.
I don't hear shit.
You can't hear anything?
Maybe you're not.
How about now?
There. Oh, hi, me.
These are some headphones for you, if you like that sort of thing.
Sure, I'll put those on. I'll turn this off so it doesn't ring.
I'm going to go do not disturb.
I'll do it, too.
I'm not going to do airplane mode.
I mean, it's appropriate. The guest is doing it. We should do it.
just like on flights now, they're like, airplane mode is not acceptable. You must shut your device off. You don't have
to. Oh, don't worry about it. Sorry.
I have a phone invented by Alexander Graham Bell himself, pretty much. Yeah,
it's huge.
It was his beta model.
Yeah. The cord is really long.
Every phone call is, Vince, come in here. I need you.
That's right. I get splattered with acid every time I use it.
Yeah. That's a good ringtone. I want that as a ringtone. Just Jonah, come in here. I need you.
Yeah. But I know how incredibly busy you are this week, what with the final 8 episodes and everything. Sure. So it was very kind of you to come in. And
But you're done. Well, you're on vacation, right?
Is that better?
Do you want to go? Yeah, that's better. Do you want to do this in real life?
I'm fine doing it like this. It's good.
You're okay without headphones?
Yeah, I think
good.
So.
That's fine.
I think so. Yeah. You guys keep yours on.
All right, now you turned off his phone. I mean,
I'm keeping mine on.
All right, whatever.
Yeah. Why do you need to keep yours on?
I'm
because
committed
you love
to
the sound
headphones.
Of your own voice?
I do. I sure love it. I'm going to keep talking.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt the flow, and I'm happy to be here.
There is no flow. Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I was very – so I just want to kind of get this right off the bat. I was excited but very nervous when they came to me with the idea of doing Talking Bad because, on Talking Dead, I have kind of SpongeBob energy.
Right.
And so I didn't want people to think that I didn't know the difference between the tones of the two shows and that I would come on to Breaking Bad like, the hashtag this week is Walter's bald head or whatever. But
a long hashtag. Revise it.
But I know that but I've been very adamant to tell people we're not coming in on commercial breaks and doing that. I'm not doing that stuff. The show is, people can be happy to know that the emotional tone of Breaking Bad will remain intact.
But here's the thing. Don't worry about it. First of all, we're lucky to have you doing this thing. And second of all, it's going to be awesome. Second of all, we laugh so – well, I always – it's past tense now, but we laugh so much in the writer's room on this show. It's we try to make – listen, the show is dark as hell. I mean, but we put in as much humor as we can put in on Breaking Bad, and we have as much fun in the writer's room as we humanly could, past tense, now that it's over. Mm-hmm. And – so, if it's, it's not, it does not have to, it doesn't have to be deadly, serious or anything, just because the show was dark and we had fun making it. So we should have fun talking about
it. And you
it.
Like comics. Like you, there's some, you have Bill Burr, Lavelle Crawford, Odenkirk.
Oh, yeah.
I even heard you reference a Whitest Kids You Know sketch once in an interview.
I love those guys.
Yeah, those guys are great.
Why didn't that show last longer?
It was on for a while,
Was it really?
Yeah. I used to go see him in New York when I was out there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, it should have, more people should know about them. Those guys are funny as hell.
Yeah, and the Trevor still does a ton of stuff. And Zach is like an actor now.
Okay.
So when you see guys like that, do you or if you see Bill Burr, you're like, fuck, I gotta find something for that guy.
I hate to admit, I was not aware of Bill Burr until he was brought to my attention by Sharon B. Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon B. Alley and Sherry Thomas were our wonderful casting ladies, casting directors on Breaking Bad. And Sharon called me up and said, there's this guy, Bill Burr. He's a stand-up comic and he really wants to be on the show and you should really check him out. And I looked him up on YouTube, and I was just laughing my ass off. He's hilarious.
But he's really good on the show, too.
Yeah, he's really good. And he's really good when he's funny, but he's really good when he plays it straight. My theory is that if you can do comedy, you can do drama.
Right.
It doesn't flow the other way necessarily, though. I think if you can do comedy, you pretty much necessarily, if you put your attention to it, you can do drama. But not necessarily if you are a very self-serious actor or actress without a funny bone, as it were. I don't necessarily think that every dramatic actor can do comedy.
Well, because comedy is tragedy based, essentially, and drama is not comedy based.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good way to look at it. That really, I think there's truth to that. There's all the rules of drama, in other words, apply to comedy, but all the rules of comedy do not apply to drama. Yeah, it flows the one way, but not the other.
So I definitely want to talk Breaking Bad, which I'm sure this week your lower jaw is probably going to fall off having to talk about the show.
So we'll just talk about Talking Bad. that's what the people are going to be tuning in for.
I want to kind of go back and just sort of talk a little bit about your early career, because I discovered today that you wrote a movie that I fucking loved in the 90s, which was Wilder Napalm.
Holy shit. You're the guy that saw that movie.
Loved. Did you ever see Wilder Napalm?
No, he didn't.
It was Dennis Quaid and Deborah Winger and Arliss Howard. And it was just these two guys.
That's weird. I've seen all of the Winger movies.
No, you didn't see this one. These two guys were basically like pyrokinetic.
Yeah.
And they were brothers.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of about, it was sort of a comedy about them, and Deborah Winger was in the middle. And I loved that movie so much in the 90s. And
damn.
When I saw that on IMDb, I was like, holy fuck, he wrote Wilder Napalm. I adored that movie.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So was that your first big thing?
That was the first movie, the first thing that, yeah, the first thing that ever got made professionally. I mean, not counting student films. Yes, that was my first movie. That was the first movie that I, not the first script that I wrote, but the first movie that went into production. And shot down in Sanford, Florida in like 1992. Got to visit the set one time for about two and a half days with my brother Patrick. And I went down there, visited the set, and I made a lifelong friend from it, the production designer, a guy named John Muto, who's a very talented production designer who production designed the movie. And otherwise, I have not seen it since it came out.
Really?
You know what? I'm proud of it, and the director did a nice job with it, and all the actors did a good job. It's just the problems I have with it really are script based. There are things about the about this. I'm a different writer now than I was then, and I'm not trying to convince to not like the movie. I find it a little. It feels forced. It would probably, I need to watch it again because I'm being unfair if I haven't truly seen it.
Well, it was 20 years ago.
It was. It feels, in my memory of it, it feels a little forcefully quirky. You don't have to try that hard to be quirky. I feel like I was trying hard to be quirky. I was trying hard to write dialogue that was, the dialogue for me now is a bit self-conscious. I place the blame of the things I don't like about it now on squarely on myself. I mean, I would have written the script a little differently if I had to do it now. But having said that, I was lucky that it got made. I learned a lot from the process. I met Ricky Jay on the movie.
Yep.
Ricky Jay was hired to help out with some of the visual gags of, you know, starting fires and, you know, flash paper type stuff or whatnot. I'm not sure all the details of what he added to the movie, but I'm sure it was a great deal. He was a great guy.
So where does quirk live then for you? Is it, it's not in the necessarily in the words, is it more in the situation or the,
you live on Deep Space Nine?
It, you know what, when characters are trying to be entertaining, that's when they're trying to entertain some unseen audience, that if the reality of the movie, if you take the reality of the movie as given, if, in other words, it's a fictional movie, but if you assume that you're watching real people who try to entertain an invisible audience that's not really there, is the best way I could put it. I feel like some of my early writing was sort of self-conscious in that sense, like the people talking were trying too hard to entertain an invisible audience that wasn't necessarily there. And in the case of Wilder Napalm, truly was not there.
He really did. We are constantly trying to entertain an invisible audience, and we try too hard.
I'm just trying to piss them off.
And you're doing well.
Thank you.
It's weird how I worded that. There is an audience, but I mean,
no.
But the actors, the
can't
actors
be self-conscious.
Know there's an audience, but the characters don't know there's
they
an
can't
audience.
Be self-conscious.
And when you write it that. You know, it's just like dialogue that wouldn't actually fit in anybody's mouth, you know, that kind of thing. People, unless people are very, you know, we've met a few people in our lives who are very weirdly baroque and you know, the way they would come across and whatnot. But by and large, people talk like we're talking now. They talk like normal human beings.
Yes, yeah. Vince. Yes, we do.
I concur.
But I'm glad you liked the movie, man.
Did you feel like
that? You know, I am. So.
Did you feel you sort of learned then? I mean, do you think, because you were a young guy when you wrote that, so
yeah.
Do you, that's sort of a young person thing to do of like, I'm going to show everyone how clever I am.
Yeah, that's a better, you just said in like two words what it took me like 48 fumbling words to say. I felt like it was overly clever, like I was trying to show people how clever I was, and I was not as clever as I needed to be. So,
and then from then was X-Files the next thing?
Yeah, the X-Files. Yeah, I came on the X-Files. I wrote a freelance episode of the X-Files, late season two. That was 1994. And I flew myself up to Vancouver. I said, could I visit the set? And they said, yeah, you can visit the set, but we can't. I said, ah, man, I'll get myself up there. Just you let me show up. And showed up and had such a great time meeting everybody, watching them shoot that episode. And then I got offered a job, you know, being on the staff. And I worked on that show for 7 years. In the midst of that, my second movie got made. It was something called Home Fries.
Yep.
With Drew Barrymore, Luke Wilson. And that one has script problems at the end, too, that we all understood were there, but I never was able quite to crack them. So the ending's a little off. And again, that's the fault of the writer, not the actors or the director.
When you did the freelance episode of X-Files, and then do you think that trip you took out there and, like, meeting everybody, do you think that had anything to do with you getting hired? Like, it's like he wrote a good episode and he was, a good guy to have around. Or
oh,
do you
good
think
question.
The episode was so good that they were just like, we just got to hire this guy?
Good question. I never, you know what? Probably it didn't help or hinder the fact that I went out there. There were people on the set, including the guy who plays Frohickey. Tom Braidwood was the AD, was the first assistant director. And I remember meeting him. He was, I could tell just by his general disposition, like, who is this asshole? Why is he interrupting? Why is he talking to the actors when I'm trying to get them corralled and shooting their next scene here? I think they were in desperate need at the time. Chris Carter was in desperate need for writers,
yeah.
who got the voice of the show, because it was a kind of a tricky voice to nail down. And I think I really got there at the right place at the right time. I think is the best way to put it. I don't know though. Maybe I know that, you know, enthusiasm in all its forms is attractive to people. I was happy that the folks who worked on my show were enthusiastic. The ones who were more enthusiastic were the ones that I probably liked more. So ultimately, the answer to your question may indeed be yes. It was like they knew I was an enthusiastic fan. Maybe that helped me get the job.
Yeah. But did they do that a lot in that series of just freelance episodes being written by other writers?
They were so in trouble that particular year. Season two, the show was starting to take off, and Fox, as I remembered, upped the order to 26. So they had two episodes. And at the end of 24...
26 hours of television.
Oh, yeah. And at the end of 24, you're just like, oh, my God, I'm dying. I'm dying. And now I got two more to break and write and produce and edit and she died, blah, blah. So everyone was burned out. They needed somebody to come in, and they just took a flyer on me. Yes.
Wow. So it seems like there's this... I feel like when your name comes up, there's a very specific feeling. It's like, oh, he likes, you know, this idea of, you know, with the exception of Home Fries, these movies are all sort of, there's some sort of fantastical element, whether it's pyrokinesis or whether it's aliens or whether it's a chemistry teacher cooking meth.
Yeah.
That then you have, or Hancock, then there's, you have to figure out how to ground it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what's the balance? Like, how does it... It's almost like you're trying to keep the paddle ball from snapping off the cord and constantly pulling people back in to, like, this is it. The crazier you go, the more grounded you have to try to make it, too.
Yeah, absolutely true. I mean, you know, it seems hard on the face of it, and yet it's deceptively simple sometimes, it seems to me. It's all about keeping the characters realistic, like realistic human beings, whether that character is a drunken superhero in Hancock, or whether he's, you know, I don't know, name any example, pick any example. But if a character can be, it can be Hellboy, it can be whatever. Any character doesn't have to be a flesh and blood human being, but we have to relate to them as viewers on some level that, you know, where we understand where they're coming from. We understand their motives, even if we don't agree with them. We understand, in other words, why Walter White does what he does. We don't have to sympathize. We don't have to agree. But if characters remain relatable, understandable and hopefully even sympathizable. They can have wings. They could be 100 feet tall. They can whatever. They can have one giant fist. I don't know, whatever. They can be a superhero.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, shit. Can we edit this? I just gave away the end of the whole.
Damn it!
I fucking knew it.
Can you imagine
superpowers?
Can you imagine? Well, I keep. I think what would be sort of funny is if you fight, because the timeline of Breaking Bad, it's basically like 07 to 09, roughly. Mm-hmm. So what totally could happen is feasible is someone tries to synthesize Heisenberg's blue meth.
Yeah.
Start the zombie apocalypse.
Oh, I like that.
See, you bring in some weird element at the end where people are like, what the fuck? Yeah. Are you fucking kidding me? And like their eyes would pop out with rage if you brought in that weird element at the end.
Uh-oh, is it too late for me to change?
Damn it. Yeah, no, get them all back. Cranston will come back. They'll all come back. Do you sympathize? I'm sure people are asking this. Do you sympathize with Walter?
You know, I don't really anymore. I kind of lost the ability.
You're like, come on. This guy's really fucking
he's not
up.
He's not the best guy.
No, he's really not. But that doesn't... the thing, I would have been in serious trouble if I lost interest in him as a character. I was able to continue to write the show because I found him kind of fascinating as a psychological study. Not that I'm a psychologist, but I... You know, it's... You got to be a dime store version of a psychologist when you're a writer. Sometimes you got to understand what makes your character tick, especially when you're writing for one guy, essentially for 6 years straight. And when I came to understand about midway through season one that he was just basically a big liar and was given lip service to the idea of doing what he did for his family, but in fact, what he was really doing was doing it for his own self-aggrandizement, for making him feel good about himself, I figured this guy's really interesting, and we can make him very bad indeed. And I continued to lose sympathy for him based on the decisions he was making, but he grew kind of inversely more fascinating the more sympathy I lost for him.
Was there a point for you where you were like, that's it, I've lost all sympathy?
Gosh, when would that have been? Oddly
that
enough,
came out of your brain.
Yeah,
really.
It was. There wasn't any one. It was all little baby steps down that slippery slope, I guess, to mix my metaphors.
I think it was when he got drunk at dinner with Hank and started bragging on behalf of Heisenberg.
Interesting. I haven't heard that one before.
He's a bad drunk.
Yeah, he's
a bad drunk.
But like
that's
that
good.
Moment, yeah, just because it was like you prideful son of a bit, like it just it made
everything
so
was
angry.
Fine.
Everything was fine,
and then he had to fuck it up.
Yeah. That's the part. Yeah, it's just it's such a shitty move. You know, just someone mm-hmm. just like wow.
For people who say like, oh, the show's about a guy who's a science teacher who makes meth to make money for his family. I think the show's about a guy struggling for significance. That seems to be every thing that he does is all about he wants to feel significant.
Isn't it weird that I lost sympathy for him when he got the cancer diagnosis?
That was in the first episode.
Yeah, you're supposed to feel sympathy for him.
I'm out on this guy.
He's unclean somehow.
He has to work at a car wash? Gross. Fuck that.
I mean, he was already a teacher, which was hard for me to sympathize with.
Gross.
I was like, come on!
I'm out. Just fuck with Grey Matter, you piece of shit.
That guy.
Would you agree with that? Would you agree with that diagnosis of the show, or do you feel like what is the show to you? What's it about to you?
That people shouldn't sympathize with loser teachers? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Finally.
They're all like this, every single one of them.
All of them would love it.
They all hated me when I was in school. No.
What do you think? What would you say the show's about? Like now, first of all, what did you say the show was about when you pitched it? And now what do you say the show's about? Has that changed?
That's a good question. Has it changed? I think we've been pretty consistent with what the underlying franchise is, which is we have a show in which we take the good guy and he, by sheer force of will, changes himself into the bad guy. He takes step by step, episode by episode, the protagonist turns into the antagonist. So we've been very consistent to that, faithful to that idea, I think, from the start. Having said that, I it's funny. You kind of lose track of what you thought it was going to be back in the early days compared to what it is, because the thing that it is fills your vision so much that you kind of forget where you started. But I can tell you, I was very worried when talking about sympathizability. I was very worried in the early days. I didn't ever think I would lose sympathy for this guy completely.
Yeah.
But I worried that the audience would. And so I kind of neurotically front-loaded the character, the stuff you were just talking about, front-loaded the character with a lot of reasons to give a damn about him and to sympathize with him. And for instance, he is a teacher, which is a very noble profession. He doesn't get – so we know he works hard. We know he cares about his students from that first scene that he's teaching, where he's teaching. And we know that they don't really pay attention to his – to his enthusiasm and to his knowledge, you know, they're kind of not really listening. And then he's got to go off and do the second job and scrub the wheels at the car wash because he's not making enough money at the first job. And he's got a son with CP who's very sweet, but, you know, obviously has had the deck stacked against him since the day he was born. And so I realize, you know, forensically speaking, you know, looking backward over the whole thing, I was really worried about the audience sympathizing with this guy, because I figured if they didn't feel sympathy for him when he makes this decision to do this stuff, then the show's not going to be on the air very long. And in hindsight, now that I see that people still sympathize with him when I myself do not, I find that fascinating.
I think one of the things the show, for me, that I think is masterful on the show is, again, going back to the idea of no matter how insane something might be on the show, you're like, oh my God, how is that going to make sense? And then you always find a way to very simply justify it. And you're like, oh, fuck, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. I guess I totally buy it. Like, the show has never had that moment of like, okay, come on. Like, I start to feel those moments, and then there's a scene that happens or something else happens, and you're like, shit, yeah, I totally buy that. That totally makes sense.
Good.
Which is
we keep that going.
It's sort of like when they first bring Gus Fring in, and they stack all this information against him, and then he just comes up with this very simple answers, and they're like, oh, well, I guess that checks out. By the way, poor Steve Gomez is the most anti-hunch cop I've ever seen. Everything's like, yeah, this checks out, and then it turns out to be the worst thing that they've ever seen before. That poor guy. Poor Gomi.
Gomi. Stephen Michael Quezada, another stand-up comedian. Does stand-up in Albuquerque in his hometown. Has a talk show in his hometown. That I was a guest on, and it was great fun. He does a really good job. You can find it on the internet.
Gomi?
Yeah, Gomi. He's very funny. He's very funny.
That was when we went out to Albuquerque to do the bowling thing. I think it was like the rap party for like the last season.
3 or 4.
Yeah. It was so crazy driving around Albuquerque. Like, but fucking Wendy's Motel. Like, that fucking car wash.
The place you gave all the blowjobs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like the song came into my head.
Well, that's the thing. Is that the other element, you know, and I'm fanning on you a little hard, so I apologize, but I've been wanting to say these things for a while. I rewatched the entire series again over the last month, so it would all be fresh.
Damn.
Which is fun, because then you see a bunch of stuff before, like, oh, fuck, I know, oh, shit. It's such a fun thing to do if you have the time to do it. But
it's grueling, though. It's
emotionally.
No, I'm sure it is.
Emotionally,
I watched the first 3 seasons in a row, and I was lying. I was supposed to watch them with my now wife. I was my girlfriend at the time. I was supposed to wait, and then I was watching them without her, not telling her.
Ooh.
And then, you know, she'd be, "What'd you do today?" I'd be like, "Yeah,
just as bad as Heisenberg."
Yeah, that's what it felt like. I was living a dual life, and then I felt like if I went out, I could just fucking lose. Yeah. What?
But the show seems to have this really magical confluence of the writing's great, the directing's fantastic, the acting is unreal. And the music on the show.
For acting? Unreal?
What?
I think the acting should be very real.
All right.
No, but it's like unreal.
Captain Pedantic. It's a good point. The acting is so believable, it's not believable anymore. But I mean that your music supervisor is unfucking believable. This scene where, when, you know, like Wendy goes down to the guy in the car, it's like, who's bending over to bring the rainbow? Like those moments.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like it feels like I'm going to watch the credits and it's going to be like music supervisor Martin Scorsese.
Sure.
Yeah, makes sense.
So how much was that? Did you envision that when you were sort of building the show, or did you just happen to bring someone in that was like, Vince, this is an element that you need?
You know what? I I got so lucky so many times with this thing. And the first bit of luck music wise was that we had an executive. I got one of the best notes I've ever gotten, and it was from an executive, because executives get a bad rap that they give idiot notes, you know. And we had an executive, and it's really not true. Not always, anyway. We had a woman named Christina Wayne, who was an AMC executive, and when I directed the pilot, I cut together a temp music track to it, and I brought my iPod to work to the editing room, and just later just fucking troweled music onto the pilot, all my favorite songs and whatnot. And this executive, Christina, watched the pilot. She says, "It's really good except for the music." I said, "What's wrong with the music?" She says, "It's just wall to wall. Do you not believe in your own work?" And she like pulled me up short with that statement. She said, do you really think that you just gotta do this manic song and dance, musically speaking, to keep people watching?" And she really got me seeing it completely different, because TV, I think it's starting to change a little bit. I sense that it's starting to change a little bit now, but TV for the last 20 years has been just music wall to wall, whether it's score that's written specifically for the episode or whether it's needle drops, like I was doing, songs that pre-exist. And so she really made me see it a completely different way, and she said, "I don't think there should be hardly any music in this thing at all." And we met somewhere in the middle. We have very little music on Breaking Bad, certainly compared to a lot of other TV shows. But all credit is due, aside from that great note I got from an executive, all credit is due to our composer, a guy named Dave Porter, who writes the specific music for the show, music specifically written for the show. And our music supervisor, Thomas Golubich, who has fantastic taste in music and consistently comes up with songs, A, that I've never heard of, although to be fair, that's not a high bar to pass if I haven't heard. I'm like, if it's not Hank Snow or some sort of hillbilly music, I've never heard of it. Elvis Costello, who is this you speak of? But I've heard of Elvis, of course, but... he would come up with songs I've never heard of, and he would come up with stuff that I would never in a million years have thought of putting against certain pieces, certain pictures, certain bits of footage. And he just consistently would come up with these incredible choices. And Dave Porter would come up with incredible score. So, and they also knew, both of them knew not to overdo it. They knew to you know, you print too many dollar bills, suddenly each individual dollar's worth left is worse. Geez, I can't fucking talk. is worth less.
Oh, get ready, because in a couple of days, actually the next 8 weeks.
I know, right? But
you're gonna forget who you are.
I know, I forget my own name. But you know, it's like print too much money, the value of the money goes down. Put too much music, too much score in a, you know, the music itself ceases to have meaning. But so they would choose their moments very wisely.
But even in the car wash, it was a very specific type of 80s music.
Oh, yeah.
It was like they weren't the most obvious 80s songs. It was like, you know, kind of a deep cut Thomas Dolby song, mm-hmm. or kind of a deep cut Fix mm-hmm. song. Or, it was like, yes, that would fucking play in a car wash.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that's born of two things. That's born of Thomas's brilliance and also born of the fact that historically we had very little money for music on this show, so we had to go to the deeper stuff very often. Although I think Thomas would have done that anyway, based on his taste.
Something, a couple things that I might be reading in too much to stuff. Number one, I like the idea that, you know, they tell the in-laws that Walter is addicted to gambling,
right?
But he actually kind of is. It's just not like card gambling.
Yeah.
He's into like he's into like life gambling.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's well put. It's well, in general, the deeper point to be made there is that, and I think this is true in life as well as in Breaking Bad. The best lies contain a very large kernel of truth. So you know, the best lies we've told one another or ourselves are the ones that, you know, there is a big hunk of truth in the middle of it all. So,
yeah.
So Walt is very good at, well, and actually that was Skyler telling that particular lie, but Skyler's kind of a virtuoso herself in terms of lying. And as she says at one point, I think I learned from the best.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, you have to, you know, it's great that it's, you know, obviously Walt is very much the focus of the show, but you still take the time to go through and give everyone their own little personal, like, they're all sort of breaking back. It's like, it's not just him,
right,
throughout the body of the show. Did you know that you were going to do that going into the show, or as you were getting through it, you're like, yeah, I probably should kind of branch out?
Well, I really, I thought when we started, I thought in terms of, this is going to be a story about one guy's evolution or devolution, if you will. I mean, he's going to go from being a good guy to a bad guy, so he's going to change with every episode. I guess I was thinking mainly in terms of him changing, but as you get in a writer's room and you got six really excellent writers working with you, and you've got excellent actors who are capable of playing a great many different emotions and moments, you start to realize, I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer now. It sounds like, duh, you know, obvious, but they all need to change. If Walt's changing, he's bringing them down with him. He's making their lives change too. So
chemistry.
Yeah. Chemistry, yeah. And interactions, chemical interactions, and whatnot, and so, and luckily we had actors who were capable, all of them, more than capable of playing a great many colors and emotions and flavors and whatnot, and able to do pretty much anything ranging from the darkest drama to the funniest comedy.
Yeah.
Well, luckily they all. So something you were saying earlier, you know, I really do like comedians and comedic actors, and I didn't realize just how funny all of our actors were capable of being. I knew how funny Brian was capable of being, but got so lucky with Aaron Paul, for instance, because he was not intended to be around for very long originally. But this guy, he's just brilliant. He's got great comic timing. He's funny as hell. But he can also he's got that kind of range. They all do. They're just so lucky with the casting.
Okay, so that hits an interesting point, which is did the show, how much of the entire series was mapped out in your head, or did you go season to season, or are there things that you're doing now that you always intended to do, or did it kind of evolve naturally?
I'd love to say I had a master plan in place from the get-go, but I really didn't. Other than that. Franchise that as it were that pitch of we're going to take Mr. Chips and turn him into Scarface. We abided by that, and we really didn't waver from that. But plot wise, for instance, you know, I can't say I knew it was all heading when I've already said publicly a great many times that I thought I was going to kill Jesse Pinkman when it all started. You know, in the first season, I thought I was going to do that. So the great thing about TV is, you can have a plan, and you can be very rigid and orthodox about it. You can say, I know we're going to go five seasons, and I know we're going to get to this particular moment, and it's going to be wonderful. But I feel now, especially that I've done this job, I feel you're robbing yourself as a showrunner if you make those kind of pronouncements and are overly orthodox about hewing to them. You lose a great deal of potential fun. I mean, the actors bring so much to the role. The writers bring so much. The crew, the directors, bring so much. Things that you find along the way, discoveries that you make, happenstances, moments where you have to turn lemons into lemonade. I mean, we lost key actors along the way to other TV shows. We lost a location along the way that was very important to us. You have to roll with these punches. You have to. A big part of your job is making lemonade out of lemons. And at the moment, those disasters, quote unquote, and sometimes they are pretty disastrous, but when those disasters, quote unquote, strike, you're just ready to pull your hair out. You're ready to just, you know, oh my God, we're done for. But then you just got to roll with it. And sometimes the best moments come out of those disastrous ones. All of that to say, if you say from the get-go, I know where it's all going to end, you kind of, you're either deluding yourself or you're going to be so rigid about it that you're going to cut out a great deal of wonderful moments that you would otherwise have had.
Yeah, I know I said this on the panel, but I keep it's sort of haunting when you watch the whole series and then you watch the first 5 minutes of the pilot and Walter's standing up at the front of the room of the classroom and he's talking about chemistry and he says growth, decay, transformation.
Yeah.
That's the entire series. He sets it up in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, in broadest strokes it is, and we abided by that. It was a show I was pitched. It was to the executives. I said, this is a show about process, the process of a guy Whoops, sorry. That's a guy like one of, you know, any one of us, a law-abiding citizen, becoming a criminal. What's the process that that takes? How do you do that? How do you go about that? So it was a show about that. It was a show about transformation, transforming a character from who he was to who he will become. So we stuck with that, and I knew that was the heart of it all. So it was nice to be able to make that, to plant that flag, to make that statement of intent in that, essentially that first or second scene of Act One of the pilot. But how you get there specifically, that's where the fun resides. That's where, you know, all the nitty gritty of it, the stuff you got to roll with, those punches you got to roll with. That's the fun of it.
What was is there one thing that stands out to you that was born out of the actor's relationships to their character, where you were like, oh, that's good, and then that developed into a thing that we all came to accept?
That's a great I'm trying to think of a great example for a great question. A more general way to answer it, I probably have said this before, but it's a good example. You know, aside from the Jesse Pinkman example, the guy was too good to kill, essentially, in the first season. The actor was too good for me to kill off his character. A good example I always give is Hank Schrader, is Dean Norris, who plays him. Hank was very schematic. If you look back in that pilot episode, and I'm proud of that pilot episode, but if you look at it, if you deconstruct it, that was the one time I was working all by myself before I had all these great writers and directors and actors and crew. And I'm proud of the job I did, but you can see how if I had like a million years to do literally all of it by myself, it would be so much poorer as a work of art, as a story, as a you know, because it would be one voice instead of, you know, many. And for instance, schematically, you know, I was very schematic, writing Hank in that first episode. He basically was everything Walt was not in that first episode. He's like, hey, buddy, hey, how you doing? He's hail fellow well met. He comes in, he takes over Walt's 50th birthday party, and he just kind of rolls in. And clearly the subtext is that Walt's own son loves the uncle more than he loves his dad. And he's a man's man, and Walt is not, and Walt looks weird with a gun in his hand, and all fun stuff, and I think it works, but the show got deeper and richer when we realized, as one example, we realized Dean Norris was capable of playing much more than that. There was much more to the actor playing the, at least in that first episode, somewhat schematic role, and he. Knowing him, getting to know that he himself is a guy who comes across when you meet him in real life. You know what I'm talking about. You meet Dean Norris in real life. Hey, how the fuck are you? Hey, buddy. And then you realize he went to Harvard, and you realize he's very well read. And
Dean Norris went to Harvard.
I had no idea.
He went to Harvard. Yeah, not
Harvard School of Auto Body Repair, or actual Harvard.
I'm less impressed now.
But he can't build a car, though.
No, can he? No.
And he loves poetry. He loves. You could talk books with you, you know, way better than I can. That's for sure. And there's a depth of feeling to him, that. Does not initially come across in the way Hank was written or what I asked Dean to do in playing Hank in that first episode. But the more you get to know this guy, the more you think it's a crime to not deepen this character, to make there be more to Hank.
And was there anything that you can think of that you wanted to do with one of the characters that you always want to do, but just you couldn't justify it or make it work in some way? Or do you feel like you got to do everything you wanted to do?
She's going to kill me that we never actually did this. Betsy Brandt, we talked for the longest time about trying to figure out a way for her to accidentally shoot the UPS man. Spoiler alert, it doesn't happen.
So it does not, the show does not end that way.
But Betsy, by the way, god damn, she is funny.
She was so funny on the bowling episode with her. The genuinely hilarious.
Oh, she's I've said ever since the first year we worked in the show, I said, you need your own talk show. You seriously, Betsy, you need your own talk show.
Well, she's doing the sitcom now.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see it. And the clip I saw of it, she just looks funny as hell.
So let's talk a little bit about, I'm sure you've been asked about this too, but the idea of colors playing into, you know, Walter White, Jesse Pinkman, even Skyler. Betsy's purple. Likes purple.
Yeah.
You know, there's two things that I've noticed is colors and baldness.
Yes.
There's a lot of shaved heads and baldness on the show.
Yes, yes.
With, you know, Mike and then ultimately even Ted Beneke and Walter and Jesse shaves his head and Dean, Hank. And so it's, I see colors and baldness. Was that part of the master plan?
That colors were part of the master plan. Baldness, unfortunately, was not. it just sort of turned out that way with the baldness. More and more male characters. We're at a point where, like, let's just shave all the women's heads, too.
LaBelle Crawford? LaBelle's going to shave them?
A lot of those guys just showed up that way. And, I mean, it made sense for Walt to go there. Hank always was there.
Yeah.
Mike Ehrmantraut, when Jonathan Banks showed up, that's how he sports his noggin there.
Yeah.
And LaVelle and...
Holly.
Yeah, Holly, maybe Holly,
Bald. What about the colors?
The colors, it was always important to me, and also right from the get-go, we had a wonderful, everybody in the crew was great, but we had an excellent production designer, Rob Wilson King, who later on left the show and was replaced by the also excellent Mark Freeborn. As production designer, you're thinking in terms of you're setting the look of the show. You're by building the sets, helping pick the locations, thinking in terms of the visuals of the show. And so right from the get-go, Rob Wilson King was interested in my idea of letting colors help tell the story, or the color palette help tell the story, as was Kathleen DeToro, who was our excellent costume designer. And then later on, she left the show and was replaced by Jennifer Bryan, who also took the baton from Kathleen and found, the idea of it. And it, you know what it is? It's not about... So all these four folks were vital to it. And it's really, it's not about the individual colors themselves. It's about the fact that they change, I think is the short answer to the question of why do you notice the colors on the show? And we always wanted them to be there. We didn't want them to be too super noticeable, because sometimes if things draw attention too much to themselves, they tend to distract. But the idea... And whether we pulled it off or not completely perfectly is open to debate. But the idea was, even from in the pilot...
You're spraying the stuff into the flames, all the different colors?
Well, you know what? You know, that was something I can't take credit for. That was, we had a chemistry / teaching advisor on the set who offered that. You know, you always want something visual. If it's just a guy talking, you're like, how can we jazz this up a little? And this gentleman on set, who was a high school chemistry teacher, was helping us out, said, hey, I got this thing. You squirt these different chemicals into a Bunsen burner, and they make different colors. That's a nice kind of an echo of the color thing. But how
was his meth?
His meth was,
Did he watch and go, everything that you've just, I mean, did he basically figure out a way to make meth? And then we never saw him again after season two. He just disappeared.
He went off and, But the colors, it was really about the changing of the colors rather than the colors themselves. In the pilot, it's a microcosm of the idea. Walt starts, if you look closely, Walt starts very beige, very bland. Different shades of khaki and beige, essentially. And by the end of it, he turns green. He gets some green in his wardrobe. And in microcosm, that happens in the pilot. But because you never know if you're going to have anything past the pilot, so you figure better leave it all on the field right here and now. But in macrocosm, we would pick with the help of my production designer and my costume designer. Every season, we'd have a discussion of color evolution. So you'd start. Every character would have they'd start a certain color, and then they'd change wardrobe wise, and then change to another color by the end of the season. A great deal of time was spent thinking and talking about this, and I can't really tell you what all the colors meant necessarily. It could have been as simple sometimes as differentiating one character from another, but purple seemed like a good color for Betsy to go against her black hair. And I like the idea of one character being very consistent. So she really, although, You may see a little change in her even by the end of it all. But a little spoiler alert. But yeah, that's a little exclusive for you there.
Thank you
For your Nerdist listeners and
analyzing. Yeah. What does that mean? What could that mean?
Chris, clear your schedule for the rest of the day. We got to talk about this.
We need out the whiteboards.
Delivery guy accidentally shoots her.
But I think I was thinking of the Fanta girl on the Fanta, the black haired Fanta girl. Yeah. I was saying because she was the one that had the purple. All those were the purple on the Fanta commercials.
You're right. Well, I got a bunch of questions from Reddit who adore. The show, by the way. This is from Green Tea for Me. This is the name of the Reddit username. Walter White is notorious for putting himself in risky, life-threatening scenarios and being able to quickly formulate a method to outsmart his opponents. There is sort of a MacGyver, Mr. Wizard meets Blow kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, Vince has mentioned a few times that while writing, he and his team would often wind up digging themselves into a hole. So the question is, what has been the most difficult hole that you've had to dig yourself out of?
Excellent question.
Yeah.
The one that springs to mind, and we did. We got a perverse sort of satisfaction for digging ourselves into holes, and then wandering around slapping ourselves on the forehead, saying we're fucked, we're fucked, we're never getting out of this one. Oh, we're dead, man. Game over, man.
Game fucking over.
Yeah, a little Bill Paxton there. That's awesome.
Oh, Billy P.
Yeah. The one that springs to mind, we had a lot of them. The one that springs to mind that seemed particularly dangerous because we really thought we were going to have to go backwards and unwind a lot of really good, fun stuff was when we had Hank in the junkyard outside the RV, and Walt and Jesse are trapped inside.
How the fuck do you get those guys out of there?
How the hell are we getting them out of this one? And we were stuck. The reason Walter White is so brilliant is because he comes up with, inside of 10 minutes, what it takes 7 reasonably smart people the better part of a week to come up with. He comes up with his plan. It took us, probably 7 of us, the better part of 3 solid days to come up with the way out of that one. And a lot of the rejected ideas are given voice by Jesse before Walt comes up with his very simple but very devious plan.
By the way, can we throw now we need to throw a little credit to a character that I really would have loved. I wanted to watch a whole show about him. Larry Hank and Old Joe.
Oh yeah.
Like the smartest.
The greatest junkyard lawyer ever. Oh yeah. Larry Hank
and brilliant scientist too when they build the electromagnet. You know, like that guy, I was just like, oh fuck, I want to see a whole show about that guy.
Yeah. And if you listen closely too, in season 5A there, it's clear he was the guy who built the mobile lab that they use inside the pest control houses.
Oh!
He is, because they say, you know, Joe and his guys, you have to listen real close, but there's a scene, it's the scene in which Walt, is first time Walt ever spends any screen time with little Brock, the boy he poisoned.
Right.
So they're talking through the blueprints, and they're having a beer and talking through the blueprints, Walt and Jesse, in Jesse's living room, and he says, yeah, what about this? Well, I think if we make this pressure vessel screw onto the top of the thing or the motor, the stirring motor, blah, blah, blah. But old Joe and his guys think, because we call that guy Old Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah, the character. So even though we didn't see it, apparently they built the rig as well. So
why did I was really trying to figure out what was Walter's end game with poisoning Brock? What was his...
His end game was he had to get FaceTime with Jesse. He really had to. He was at a place where he was up against a superior opponent, a guy who was arguably smarter than he was, who had blocked his every chess move, and including he had basically through a lot of machinations that Gus Fring had put into motion. Jesse and Walt, I mean, they had beaten the living hell out of each other in that big fist fight they had. Jesse really, at that point, didn't seem to care whether Walt lived or died, and Walt was a dead man. As soon as Jesse was able to cook a reasonably good facsimile of Walt's meth, Walt would be, at that point, done for. So he knew he was dead regardless. The worst thing that could have happened was that Jesse himself would have just come over and shot him right in the head, which we thought, honestly, that in the writer's room, better if that's the worst case scenario of getting Jesse over there, better Jesse does it than Gus Fring himself.
Right.
The best case scenario was they get face to face and Walt says, listen to me, listen to me. You're not a killer. I've done a lot of bad things. Do you really believe I would poison a child? Do you really believe? Think about who wants you to believe that.
Yeah.
And it was all about getting Jesse back in his side. And so it was the most devious thing I think we ever came up with in the writer's room. And one of those moments we were most proud of, because when we said, okay, and then the whole season ends with that shot of the Lily of the Valley.
Yeah.
It was just like, and I think, you know, it was not Ryson. It could have been, I mean, here's the thing. It could have been Ryson. And the kid could have died. This is the one small tip of the hat Walt gave toward, you know, the rest of humanity, in the sense that he knew he was making the kid sick. He purposely didn't kill the kid. He was making him sick.
Is that the worst thing you think he's done, or is the Jane thing the worst thing he's done?
Well, Jane pretty much did it to herself.
No, she did, but he basically. If Jesse hadn't come in, if Jesse hadn't moved, she wouldn't have fallen off on her off of her side.
Yeah, he didn't mean to knock her over on her side. If you look closely, he inadvertently kind of plops her over on her side, but he didn't mean to do that. But it's a very huge sin of omission to watch someone, you know, to be standing at the end of the dock, so to speak, and you've got the life preserver in your hand and the person's drowning, and you think about it and you say, nah, I'm not throwing that to you. I mean, it's bad. Yeah. That was a bad moment.
Because you're fucking with causality in that season of, you know, having to see, like, this is the result of one person's shitty action can create this whole, you know, this whole, like the plane crash and the, you know, all the stuff that you'd been teasing in the cold opens throughout the season with the pool.
Yeah, yeah.
So was your idea to sort of show people, like, these are the kinds of global consequences that happen from one person's actions?
Yeah. TV historically doesn't deal with consequences well. And it's not for lack of brilliance on the part of, you know, or, you know, whatever, on the part of TV writers or a desire to do it. It's just historically TV is about maintaining stasis, because you want those characters you tune in to watch week in and week out to remain the same people throughout the lifespan of the show. And the producers of the show want the show to go on 10, 15, 20 years so they make the most amount of bucks out of the thing. So TV historically is about maintaining stasis.
You just described Dick Wolf.
Well, and by the way, and this guy, he knows, I never met the guy, but he knows what he's doing. He's, you know, you can watch an episode of Law and Order in season 18.
Yeah, it's delightful. Syndication works first.
Oh, my God. The guy's a billionaire. Yeah. And you know what you're going to get, and what you're going to get, especially if you're a fan of Law and Order, I thought it was a damn good show. But it's literally, you know you're going to get something very similar to what you got in season 1 that you get in season 18 or 15 or whatever, and it works, and it's designed to work that way.
Lenny would have caught Walt. Lenny would have caught him.
Yeah. Lenny was great. I loved Jerry Orbach. He was awesome. But my point being, I figured it'd be fun. There was room on the television dial, as it were, to try something different, to try something a story in which the main character changed. You know, as we were talking about, it's a story about transformation. The whole point of the show is transformation. So therefore, that frees you up to involve things like causality, and to basically, for the easiest way to put it, is to allow that actions have reactions in the world of Breaking Bad, as they do in real life. Because if you're watching Nash Bridges or you're watching, or hell, use X-Files as an example, you're watching X-Files. We had episodes, and I'm proud as hell of that show, but that show had to more or less exist in that self-imposed stasis world of television as well. Otherwise, it wouldn't have lasted as long as it did. So we had times on X-Files where Mulder would shoot a perp in his own apartment, and then the next week, there's no mention of it. And in real life, and I'm proud of that show, and that's the way it had to be. That's the way it has to be typically in television. But in real life, you shoot someone, especially in your own home.
A lot of paperwork.
How am I gonna sleep in my house after
even
this?
In the X-Files computer game, Scanner would take your badge and gun.
It's just like, how do you? There's no, there's very little typically in television. Very little very little consequence to one's actions.
Right.
So living, you know, we're really freed up knowing the show wouldn't last forever, knowing the show, in fact, would last, well, it turns out it lasted 62 episodes, but it was a finite creation. Knowing that frees you up to allow for whole seasons, in fact, like season two, to be about causality, to be about actions having reactions, to be about actions have consequences, you know, ending in that season with this rain of aircraft debris falling from the sky, so...
Do you feel like it was the cancer that changed him, or what do you think in your mind was Walter always
looking for a reason,
kind of a liar, or always looking for something, or was that his? He does say I'm awake now, right? Do you think that it was it the cancer?
I think the cancer woke him up. The big question, the $64,000 question that I don't pretend to have the gospel answer to. I like for people to argue this amongst themselves. But the big question that arises from Walt's cancer diagnosis in that first episode is, did that knowledge change fundamentally who he was, or did it awaken something? He actually says, I'm awake. But, I mean, in other words, this is the old expression about Hollywood. You know, some people say Hollywood, success in Hollywood doesn't change you so much as it reveals your flaws. It reveals who you really are. Is so did Walt... in going down this path, reveal things that were always within him, or did he actually change and become someone different?
That's really interesting you say it about Hollywood. I think it's just, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily a success. Maybe it is success in general, because
maybe in general,
the
yeah.
byproduct of success can be you're not as held in place by your peers anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the more you do something, or the more people are like, yes,
yeah.
And then you have less boundaries.
Yeah,
you have
yeah.
less barriers.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what it is. It's when the barriers start breaking down, that's when it's, you know.
I think that's the best way to put it. I think when those societal barriers, when those barriers, those behavior barriers start dropping away, it's my girlfriend, who was a former teacher, taught me a great quote. I'm probably quoting it a little bit wrong, but one of Mark Twain's great quotes, and, you know, he was full of wonderful lines. One of them was, there are a great many cures to temptation, but the most potent one is cowardice. It's like, you know, the fear of getting caught, the fear of you know, prison or death or whatever keeps us from doing some of the things that we in the dark of night we think about doing, we fantasize about doing. And maybe Walt had that cowardice removed.
Lifted
up. Yeah, lifted.
And do you think that's why when he went and got checked up again and they said the cancer was in remission, like he kind of had like a freak out.
He had a freak out. He did indeed. And that was
like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to have to keep on dealing with this stuff.
You were exactly right. And that's we had fun with that. That was also a hard one. That the episode after the 4 days out episode, the episode that ends with him getting the news that his cancer's in remission, and he punches the hell out of the paper towel dispenser. Yeah. The episode after that, which was written by Moira Wally Beckett, who did a great job with it, we were really all of us at sea with that next episode, because we were like, what happens now? Because he's clearly freaking out that he doesn't have this excuse anymore, this cancer excuse. Yeah. This excuse, in other words, to break bad, to continue to break bad. So we're like, now what do we do? Because it just doesn't feel right that he should immediately keep cooking meth. So we had a sort of a not a placeholder episode. That's not the right way to put it. But we had some breathing room there. And he goes off instead, and he finds rot in his sub basement, you know, or in his in the timbers under the house. And suddenly he's like a complete nut about getting rid of the mildew. Yeah.
And you know, there was a callback to that scene where he goes. I think it was maybe in the last episode of the season where he goes back. And he stares at the – he gets another checkup and stares at the paper towel dispenser that he had punched.
You're right.
And you don't really know what what they said, what's going on. But then in the montage of them cooking meth with the tents, you start to see when there's an overhead shot of all the tents in the neighborhood, they're kind of like multiplying.
Yeah.
And like that seems to me like it's like alluding to – like with those two scenes combined, like maybe he got it back and those are the cells spreading again. I don't know. That's kind of what I took away from it.
Mm. Oh, shut up. You can't say anything.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I guess you're right with the last fucking episode.
God damn it. Scene.
I like it. I like it. I think it's cool.
That was a great, that was a great montage too. The last montage in that.
That was again written by Maura Wally Beckett and directed by Michelle McLaren, who as we speak is in Iceland doing Game of Thrones. Directing Game of Thrones.
Great.
Yeah. And which is, it's her third and fourth episode she's done for them because they always, they block shoot two episodes at a time. And she is a one badass director.
Yeah.
She is so talented. And when you meet her, she's so cute and sweet and, lack of a better way to put it, girly. I mean, in the best possible way. And
the darkest things come out of her mind.
She is the most badassest action director. And we've got some badass action directors, but she's the one who did the amazing sequence with the two cousins in the parking lot trying to kill Hank. You know, she killed off all the, with the poison by the pool in Mexico, she killed off all the capos.
Oh, and then also the...
Don Eladio.
And also in the prisons when all
those... And yes, and she did the prison.
That was so... That was... Yeah. Those little, like... I don't know if the looping on if the ADR on that was just like stabbing dry sponges, but that like that was so fucking gross.
That's a guy named Nick Forshager, who is our sound effects editor and who comes up with that stuff. He and his guys and then our mixers Jeffrey and Eric do such a great job. Yeah, the music, the sound work on this show I always want to talk about too, because the amount of detail, the amount of artistry that goes into it to make all that stuff seem more real, and like you said, the stabbings. Yeah. It's just, it's one thing to look at it, and the way Michelle directed it, it's just badass and horrifying. But then when you're hearing it with the artistry that goes into making those sound effects, it's just like, makes it 10 times
worse. Or like an ATM falling on a skull.
Yeah. a lot of layers of sound effects.
Someone here on Reddit wanted to know what happened to that kid. What happened to the...
Baby Spooge.
Baby Spooge,
We call him Baby Spooge.
That's where he came from.
It was the guy's name was Spooge.
And she kept calling her Skank.
Yeah, but we called her Mrs. Spooge. There was Spooge and Mrs. Spooge.
So in the eyes of the Lord, they were a union.
Yes.
All right, good.
And then Baby Spooge.
Yeah, that crunch. Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
I you know, that's up to the viewer. I mean, I don't mean to it really is, because we never
you
answered.
Never resolved
I would like to believe, and the way I look at it, I believe that he went to unfortunately to a foster home, but actually I shouldn't say it that way. Fortunately to a foster home, because just any place would be better than
where
the crack house he was living in. Yeah.
So this is from and by the way, the people that you get to play the meth addicts, like Wendy.
Oh yeah.
Fucking so good.
Yeah.
The
guys in the house when Jesse distracts with the digging.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
guys are perfect.
There was, I need to say, because I mentioned something about earlier in our podcast that where Wendy gave all the blowjobs. I need to say, the woman who played Wendy is absolutely delightful and absolutely nothing at all in any way, shape, or form like Wendy the character. She is a triathlete. She used to be a professional triathlete.
Oh, performance-enhancing drugs.
No, and that's why she has, like, zero body fat, because she's a fantastic athlete. I think she and her husband ran triathlons.
Wow.
And she's the nicest lady, and she has a perfectly beautiful set of teeth that we mess up with prosthetic, orthodonture or whatnot. And she's actually a very nice and sweet and attractive lady who we really make look scabby and nasty. And we do that with all these actors who play tweakers. Yeah.
Are there any pressure, or do you feel any social pressures when you're writing a show that's essentially, you're certainly not glorifying drugs or the process. I mean, you lift the dirty mattress and see all the cockroaches scattering underneath.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you feel like there's any sort of social responsibility because of the subject matter to make sure that you let people know, like, you know, that it, maybe it's not so much like, well, you guys decide if it's bad, where you got to go. No, we really should let people know that it's bad.
No, it's a good question. And I have to say, just as I worried in the early days about Walt remaining as sympathizable as possible for as long as possible, I worried in the early days, it's almost like I've forgotten it now, it's been 6 years, but we worried in the early days that folks out there who like to weigh in, yay or nay, on whatever new crop of TV shows.
You're just referring to the Cheers and Jeers section of TV Guide.
I was thinking more of the parents' resource. So that kind of weighing folks. In, yeah. I was, and by the way, let me start by saying Breaking Bad is not meant for kids,
right.
Clearly, as a TV show. But, and it's not, you know, it's not a show for a lot of adults out there either, to be honest. It's kind of an acquired taste, like, you know, we worried in the early days, people going to think we were somehow glorifying meth use or criminality. And people got that that's not what we were doing. So it got to the point, probably in the early days, I thought a little more than we wound up thinking about in later seasons. I thought, gee, are we showing enough how bad this is? And it turns out we didn't need to police ourselves too much in that regard. We just needed to be truthful about it. And the truth is, as with a lot of illegal drugs, meth does something for people. It makes them feel really good for a short amount of time. And then it just fucking destroys your life. And if you show both sides of that, so that then we'd have scenes like Jesse floating up to heaven when he's on heroin, floating up through space, which was done with this amazing rig that the grip department built.
Yeah, that
for
looks
us.
Really cool.
Fantastic idea that Adam Bernstein, the director of that episode, came up with, and the grip department built this rig, and that was all done practically. They literally mounted the camera over him. That was not some weird CG effect.
Yeah.
He really was being lifted 30 feet in the air as he was acting out a heroin high.
And so there was no, like, you didn't composite anything out?
No composite.
It was just like a thing underneath them?
It was like a crane arm with him lying on a sort of a support, lying flat on his back, and then the camera mounted equidistant. I mean, it always stayed equidistant from him, so it stayed in focus. And then the grip department rose it up through the it was on a soundstage set, so there was no ceiling.
Okay.
And we got right up to the top where you would begin to see the edges of the top of the room. And it was all done practically. All of that to say, you know, that's presented as, ooh, it feels really good to be on heroin.
Sure.
And then, because, you know, that's the thing that the war against drugs doesn't really want to tell people is that, you know, if it didn't feel good, nobody'd be doing it.
Yeah.
But what you need, and that's okay. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to say that it feels really good. But then it's the how good it makes you feel isn't worth it, because then it just fucks up your life.
That was some train spotting level of, you know, like that those visualizations.
Yeah,
of the drugs.
Yeah. That's a good movie.
Like the
Trainspotting.
Such a great
like
movie.
The acid scene in Ray Donovan. If anyone's keeping up,
haven't
with
seen
Ray
it. This is from Divinidal, who wants to know which character did you find was complex or tricky to write? I guess what was your hardest character to tackle?
Oh God, good question. God, it was all hard. It was it was all so hard, but satisfying and enjoyable. You know what I always say? I like people say, "Do you like writing?" And I always say, to be precise, I like having written. I like talking about it in hindsight.
You
know, it's I'm proud of the work we did, but while you're doing it, it's like, you know, do I enjoy pulling my own teeth out one by one? No, not so much. I like the feeling when it stops, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think of the hardest. For me personally, the hardest, it's no one character on Breaking Bad. I felt they were all, I enjoyed writing all of them. The hardest scenes to write for me are scenes that involve, like, technical jargon or what, stuff that I don't really understand. And then you got to go get help. If
right.
Walt, for instance, is talking chemistry, as he does in the episode where that really tense, long scene where Gus Fring shows up at the super lab after Gail Bettiker's murder by Jesse, and he starts putting on the waterproof outfit, and he gets the carpet knife, you know, the box cutter, and Walt has to spew a lot of Kim talk at that point, chemistry stuff about
trying so harsh.
He's trying so, and I didn't, you know, and I hate just writing blah, 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 and then filling it in later, because I'm very linear in my writing. I want to start at the beginning and write all the way through, and I don't want to leave big swaths of, I'll fill this in later. So, because I'm real, I don't know, weirdly neurotic that way. But we had a great deal of help from Dr. Donna Nelson at the University of Oklahoma, who's a head of the, I think she heads the chemistry department there, but she's a...
Hope so.
I mean, I think she's a head of the department. She's definitely a very smart chemist who knows her stuff. And so I got in touch with her, and she said, "Why don't you have him say this, have him say that?" And I'm just, I'm typing this stuff down. I don't even. It's just like Greek, you know, because I never actually took chemistry. But those are the hardest scenes to write when you're talking legalese or doctor talk or chemistry talk, stuff that you're not a natural at. But I found all the characters. I loved writing for all the characters. I didn't love one more than the other. They're all sort of my babies, you know. They're all sort of my children. I kind of loved them all. Saul was particularly fun to write for.
I'm
being honest here,
I
Saul,
would imagine.
Yeah, because he's just because the rest of the time, sort of what we were talking about Wilder Napalm. Most of these characters don't try to be funny or glib or witty, except for Saul Goodman, because he talks a mile a minute. So writing his dialogue was probably more often it was a little more fun.
I said this at the panel too. I think Saul is the most grounded character because he's the only character who does not live a double life. He admits exactly who he is.
Yeah.
There's no struggle between a perception and who he is. He's just that guy, and
he shows his fear too.
And he's the most comfortable with himself of all the characters.
Absolutely true. He is the most honest with himself. This is who I really am, and he's the most comfortable with himself. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
There was a thing that in the Walking Dead comic books they did where they actually ended up putting out a novel with the backstory of what the character
Rise of the Governor.
Rise of the Governor.
Yeah, right on.
And I always ever since Gus went away, I've always wanted to just have somebody
what happened
write a
in
novel.
Chile.
Yeah.
I want to know that whole how he got all these connections, how he came into.
The only reason you're not dead is because I've heard of you.
We purposely never answered that.
Prequel movie.
But maybe so.
Fring it on.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
Well, fring it.
Yeah, I take back everything
fring
I said
it.
About it.
Yeah, fring it.
This fall on AMC. Fring it.
See, now that's exactly the kind of comment where people are like, how dare you host Talking Bad? I'm not going to say fring it on the show.
It should just be called Fring.
I guarantee you will.
Go fuck yourself, man.
I guarantee you will.
It should just be called Fring and everyone think they're tuning into new episodes of Fringe. Like, oh, I guess they must have messed it up.
In an alternate universe.
They spell it wrong on the
the Time Warner guys. They don't know what they're doing.
TV guys spell it wrong.
Are you? Is there... I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this at all, but there are some Better Call Saul swirling rumors. Is there anything to talk about there?
I'm swirling up a lot of them myself whenever I can. The best way to answer that is I very much want it to happen. Peter Gould, who created the character, the first time Saul Goodman the moment he arrived on scene was back in season 2 in an episode written by Peter Gould, one of my excellent writers. And Peter and I have been talking about what a spinoff would look like, a Better Call Saul spinoff, and we've had a lot of fun talking about it. And I hope, and he hopes that we can get it made.
Do you see it more as a comedy or?
Yeah, but you know, not an out and out comedy, not a sitcom. Breaking Bad,
not like a Lou. It's like, remember the Lou Grant spinoff of Mary Tyler Moore?
Right,
it's
right,
like,
right.
Oh, they went drama and
news. This will be more like Aftermash.
Aftermash.
No, it's you know, it's
Archie Bunker's place.
Don't you want less
Archie
laughs? Bunker's shouldn't place. You just call it Mash?
No, you know, it's. We want to do it. We want to do it right or not at all.
Sure,
so
sure.
If it dawned on us at the 11th hour that we don't really have a show here, we wouldn't do it. But I think we really do. I think we could have fun with it. I think people would enjoy it. I think people love the character. And you know, the funny thing about Breaking Bad, you know, no pun intended, is how much humor there is in Breaking Bad.
Oh,
and we did that on purpose.
You could absolutely make a montage of Walt throwing a pizza on the roof, stubbing, breaking.
So I made it seem like it was an ABC Family comedy.
I saw that. It was great.
Yeah, it was great.
It was wonderful.
It's like they put a laugh track in. They did a whole intro. Yeah. It's like, what are you doing? I'm back.
In your mind, because we're kind of coming to the end of our time with you, and I honestly would like to talk to you for 4 more hours, but I don't want to force you to do that. You're going to be doing plenty of that in the next couple weeks. But, you know, sometimes I see on television where writers will or a showrunner will throw out all these insane things at the audience and they're able to keep the audience invested.
Right.
And then at the end, they just kind of go, well, yeah, and they don't really wrap it up. Like there's no real – they don't really feel
– right.
You know, maybe either they can't because they wrote so crazy out that they couldn't find a satisfying way to end. Do you feel like Are you satisfied with the way the show, I mean, and I don't know if people would be like, well, what's he going to say? But are you satisfied with where the show ends up? Do you feel like it's tied up nicely? And are you, Vince, do you feel like it's okay to walk away from it now?
I do. And I didn't for the longest time. I mean, I knew, intellectually. I mean, I just knew, and any which way you want to slice it, I knew that this show had a limited shelf life. I knew that by its very design, as I was talking about earlier, this show needed to end. It was not a show designed to go on indefinitely, and I did not want to overstay our welcome. I have been so heartened and flattered and taken so much pride and joy in how many people love this show and pay very close attention to it and are able to talk about it to a minute level of detail that escapes even me sometimes.
Sorry.
I love it. Every time it happens, I'm just overjoyed. I'm like, God, this is fantastic. I love that I had a hand in something that this many people pay this close attention to, especially in this day and age where our attention is constantly being tugged on by a great many things, a great many media. My long-winded way of saying all this, I knew it needed to come to an end. So for the past year or more, knowing that, I'd say to my writers, how are we going to end this thing right? How are we going to make this thing satisfying and fitting? And how are we going to? We had some dark nights of the soul where I'm like, we're screwed. We can't get there from here. We can't. And I had some times where I was like, in the past year, where we're like, I don't think we're going to make it. I think we're going to disappoint people. And listen, the audience is not a monolith. Audience, there's a great many different ways you can come to a show like Breaking Bad, and a great many ways you can see it. And there will be people out there who are disappointed by the ending. I'm sure there has to be, because there'll be people out there who have it already in their mind the way it should end.
Yeah, well, because of witness protection, Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah. Exactly.
This is one of those shows, though, that you form such an intimate relationship with it that you kind of get a little precious about the show, because it really does. It hits you on so many. It hits you on a molecular level, and so there are some people who it's just like, even if they don't know exactly what it is, there's a way that it, you know, how could it not end this other way? Yeah. But as long as you feel satisfied with it,
I feel satisfied, and I didn't for the longest time. But I mean, it's not that I didn't like the direction we're heading, but I had those dark afternoons of the soul, I should say, where I'm like, oh God, we took a wrong turn. We don't have time to go back and rejigger everything. How are we going to fix everything? Ah, we don't have time. Oh God. And then one of my writers would slap the hysteria out of me, you know, figuratively speaking. Get hold of yourself. Be a man. But I am very happy to say that I am satisfied with the ending. It was hard fought. It took a hell of a lot of effort. But we came up with something that I am proud of. I feel like I feel good about it, and perhaps not everyone will agree with me, but I hope that the majority of viewers will agree. I feel good about it. That's the best I can ask.
And
for.
Do you feel like the show will give people a sense of closure?
It absolutely will give. Yes, there is absolutely a sense of closure to these final eight episodes. Whether it's the closure that you want is up to you to decide and to give voice to after these eight air. But yeah, we close the story.
It's kind of funny that you could build a thing like this show and then ultimately become afraid of it, because it kind of takes on its own life because people attach so much of their own. Yeah. Souls to it when they watch.
Sure, well, I saw that on the X-Files. I learned that on the X-Files, and it was a lesson I had not prior to that. I had not learned, and those characters, Mulder and Scully, people, they were the fans, and they'd get mad at you. This is when and why I stopped reading the internet or stopped reading this stuff. You know, I hear anecdotally things now from folks I work with, but I can't, you know, because.
Ironically, the X-Files started the internet, so.
You know, it really did. You're right, and it was a wonderful thing, and it served us wonderfully on the X-Files, and it served us wonderfully on Breaking Bad, and God bless the fans who are that vocal and that passionate, but I can't. I can't avail myself too much of that, or really at all, because it'll mess with your steering, as it were. When you're steering the story, it'll, and you
feel good about five seasons, as opposed to, like, I mean, X-Files was what, 9 or 10?
202 episodes.
Yeah, 202.
202.
Well, 203 if you count the two-parters as the.
No, I think that's the. No.
Is it 202?
Yeah, 202.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you feel like five seasons. Good, or would you want to try to?
No, you know what? One of the things I feel very I'm not a guy who feels at peace very often. I feel creatively at peace.
Oh, good.
I feel sad personally that this show is over, because it's I fear the future, and I fear
you got to fight the future.
I have to fight. Yeah, like an actor, I got to fight the future. I fear. Yeah, I'm gonna change the tagline a little. I fear the future because I fear that I will never have a job this good ever again. I will never have this level of creative satisfaction. I won't work with this wonderful bunch of people again. I fear that, in other words, it'll all be downhill for me personally from here. But when I feel myself getting nervous that way, the best thing I can say to myself is, you had it. You're lucky to have had it. Most people don't. You got really lucky.
And you might have said that coming off X-Files, too, and then you get Breaking Bad.
Well, you know, I probably did say that about X-Files.
Shut up. Come on.
You don't win the lottery three times.
I've seen it happen. Norman Lear. How many shows did Norman Lear create?
That's true.
Come on.
Listen, I don't want to psych myself out. I want to go on and do other things, but I have anything yet or no? Well, I mean, the Saul Goodman thing, we'd love to see it get going, but I'd like to try something after we get that rolling, because I really think that should be Peter Gould's show. Mm-hmm. He's earned it, and we're going to get it off the ground together, but I think it's going to be his. And by the way, all my writers are ready to go off and run their own shows, which troubles me a little bit, because if I get something going, they'll all be off doing their own thing.
Well, that's when you hire a bunch of prison Nazis to knife them with pointed toothbrushes so they don't take over your business.
Yes. Yeah. Damn it. Yeah. Hey, I like the way you think.
In the Saul show, can Matt Jones's badger be Saul's assistant?
Oh, my God.
That's fun.
I'm doing a cartoon with fun. Matt Jones right now.
Oh, he's brilliant.
And yeah, when he plays this, he plays a hilarious character in this cartoon I'm doing for Nickelodeon. And all I can hear when he does the, "Hey guys, why don't we go over here?" It's like all I can hear is Badger the whole time.
And by the way, Charles Baker plays Skinny Pete, just as brilliant.
How about that fucking moment where he's playing Solfeggetto? He's playing the. That's a CPE Bach like arpeggiated.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a fucking hard piece of music to play.
Wow.
And he's. Were you just like, oh, he can play? I'll just throw that in
there. Well, you know what? That's a good answer to one of the earlier questions. What did you learn from your actors that changed the way you wrote for them? That's a great, very concrete example right there. When we learned that Charles Baker, who is really nothing at all like Skinny Pete in real life, and in fact, I don't think he even drinks, let alone does drugs. I mean, he's just a sweet guy who I believe is a grandfather.
Oh, believe, my God.
What the fuck? Yeah.
He is about my age, which means that he's playing older than I mean, he's a youthful looking guy. He's a
youthful but that's kind
lady.
Of a genius idea to cast an older actor to play a younger meth head.
Oh, good point.
He was just great. He came in. Our excellent casting people brought him in, and we said, you know, send him to wardrobe. But he, when I learned my writers and I learned that he was a very talented musician. He's talented in a great many ways. One of them being music. We said we got to get that in there.
That's what made me feel so bad for Skinny Pete, where it's like this fucking meth head that just knows how to do this thing and he's not using it in his life at all.
Yeah,
no,
nope.
That was like, it's like, oh, what were you doing?
Yeah,
what was your life before this?
Well, you know, and we honestly we got the idea, as I just said, from the fact that he could do it in real life. But you know what it puts me in mind of? You remember American Movie?
Which I love that movie.
The guy, the buddy,
yeah.
He's like brilliant on the guitar.
So good.
And I'm like,
so fried.
Like, come on, man, do something with that. He's brilliant. Made me think of that. Yeah. Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, I'm a lefty.
You ever see Coven?
I think it's on the DVD. I think I have. You know what? Those guys. It's been a while since I've seen Coven, but I watch it. American movie over and over again. I love those guys.
Yeah, just... I love it so much. Coven, because when we saw the movie, it came to the film festival in my town, and then like we wrote the guy, and he sent us copies of Coven autographed, and I fell asleep the first three times trying to watch it. And it's like a 40-minute movie.
But you know what? You know what? The guy's got an eye. Maybe he should, you know, cinematography-wise, I just remember a lot of the footage is really nicely composed.
Yeah, like the big shots of the snow and the trees and stuff. Yeah,
there's a good composition in that movie.
Well, you can watch Ed Wood movies, too.
As we're sort of wrapping it down, I do want to give you one standing ovation for naming the Gus Fring death episode Face Off.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That was another executive note. Had a lovely young woman named Susan Goldberg, who we all call McG. She said, hey, why don't you call it Face Off? And she was joking. And I said, that's brilliant. And she said, no, that was a joke. I said, come on, what better name than that?
Yeah.
So that was an executive note.
And also you don't see, there's not really that much gore on the show. Which made that. I mean, there's a lot of like bang shooting,
There's a lot of violence, but not so much gore. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
You don't even.
Point.
It's not like you see the.
Yeah.
It's not like you see the people dissolved in the barrels. All it's like, oh, you see the barrels they're pouring. Okay, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, except for that first season when it dripped through the floor.
Yeah.
But that shot of Gus's the half face.
Yeah.
When you guys were writing that, were you like, it has to go this far?
Yeah. It was an idea. It was an image I had in my mind, literally months before we got to it. And it was like a moon launch. It was, you would imagine, you know, getting the Apollo astronauts to the moon took a lot of all hands on deck. That shot did too. Not quite as hard as getting to the moon, but, it took, first of all, wonderfully operated and shot by Michael Slovis, the DP. It was the explosion at the beginning when the door blows off. That was a nitrogen dump tank that dumped an intense amount of pressurized nitrogen and blew the door off its hinges. If you'd been standing in front of it, it would have killed you.
Yeah.
And you got to use nitrogen. And this was all the special effects department, the physical effects led by a guy named Werner Hanlein. You got to use nitrogen because if you use just compressed air, the jets of decompressing gas become visible, these white plumes that look like fire extinguishers. So you got to use pure nitrogen. So they're telling me all this. I don't know any of this shit. And so they pull that off in one take, that explosion. And then a guy named Bill Pawlowski, who's our brilliant visual effects producer, he marries the follow-up take, which is us bringing the camera around to Giancarlo Esposito's face. I was directing that day. I did 19 takes of that second half of the shot, which is married seamlessly in with the first half of the explosion. Mm-hmm. You can't tell the one frame of the one take from the other frame of the new take. It's just amazing how Bill and his
crew... Because he has to look flawless in profile.
Yeah, he has to look flawless in profile. And then you come around, and then... K&B Effects, who does all the amazing zombies for
Nicotero.
Walking Dead. Howard Berger and Greg Nicotero came up with this sculpt. They and their guys sculpted, they cast, did a life cast of Giancarlo's face, sculpted away all the damage, and did this amazing head, and Bill Pawlowski married it on the computer, the sculpt to Giancarlo Esposito's real face. And just, I don't even know how they did it. It's like magic. It's like wizardry. Yeah. But it was the result of a great many tens of thousands of man hours of discussion and hard work to make that shot look as relatively, you want it to look simple. You want it to look like, oh yeah, it's a wonder.
Yeah.
It was indeed not a wonder, but it's meant to look that way.
Well, it's going to be an intense 8 weeks for you, Adam. I mean, your work's really much done, pretty much, right? It's just now. It's just you're just kind of waiting for it to all get out there, you're probably kind of excited for it to.
Very, very excited. I it's one of those things I simultaneously want this moment to last forever, where people haven't seen it yet, you know, because it's It's because I always loved as a kid. I loved the night before Christmas more than Christmas itself.
But you still want to be able to talk about it.
But on the other hand, I want to be able to talk about it. So I'm impatient, just as I was as a kid on the night before Christmas. I want everyone to have seen them all already because I'm really excited to see people's reaction to it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, man.
And it's an honor to be able to do the after show, and we'll have fun. And,
oh, it's going
to
be awesome.
And you'll be one of the first guests on the show,
yeah,
along with Julie Bowen, who apparently is fanatical about it.
Awesome.
And it's good to see you, man. Thank you so
great
much.
Great to see you too, Chris.
All right.
Guys, this was fun.
Thanks, Vince.
A lot of fun.
Enjoy your burrito.
Awesome. So cool. When we do it for real.
Oh, that old chestnut.
Oh, whenever it runs long, it's always a good joke to throw it.
Man, I really can't thank you enough.
Oh, this
I think
was fun.
I
enjoyed it.
I appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Now, you guys are.
Thanks, man.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.